That looks like a lot like a poltergeist, because these events usually have some sort of symbolic meaning in that family. Mm. And then if we put it at the social level, we seem to have some sort of symbolic meaning associated with the UFO wave as well. You want to have proof that is an anomaly. So you want to be sure that there's no trickery and everything's controlled. By the very fact you do that, you create the conditions where the phenomenon will not happen. Something eventually will replace UFOs. What it is, I don't know. Hmm. And it's very hard to predict. But there's definitely a lot of potential for this phenomenon to die or slowly disappear, because it doesn't mean anything to people, or at least much less than in the past.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. On tonight's edition of the program, I think we're going to have a really enlightening conversation for you all. I am very excited about our guest tonight. I read his book yesterday, and it just completely blew my mind. And we've had quite an adventure getting this interview put together, but it looks like it's going to be all right tonight, I hope. And I'm very, very excited about it, because, as I said, his new book really, it just gave me all this new food for thought with regards to UFOs and the UFO phenomenon, and it's so rare that something like that comes along in UFO literature today. So I was absolutely thrilled, loved the book. The book is, of course, Illuminations, The UFO Experience as a Parapsychological Event. And the author is Eric Wallett, PhD, and he's here on the program tonight to talk about this book. And to sum it up in a way, the sort of keystone sentence on the back is, what if UFO experiences are the result of large-scale, unconscious psychic forces? Just that question. We're going to be exploring it tonight, and it opens the mind up in an amazing way. So I'm really excited about this conversation. Welcome to the show, Eric Wallett. Thank you so much for coming on the program. I really, really do appreciate it.
Hi, Tim. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure and a honor to be on your show, and I'm sure we'll have lots of fun discussing all kinds of topics tonight.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be a blast. We'll let folks in on the whole adventure at the end of the show, because I'm sure you somewhat want to know what happened, but to kick things off here on our conversation, I think you can imagine what the first question is, the bio, the background. Tell people a little bit about Eric Wallett, PhD. How did you get interested in all this, and, who are you, and how did Illuminations come about?
Well, I'm a professor in the Canadian Military Establishment with the Royal Military College of Canada. I am in Toronto teaching to senior military officers, what you guys in the United States call the War College. And I'm a sociologist. I have a PhD from York University here in Toronto. And so I'm a professor teaching, doing research, and had a long interest in UFOs. And I decided to put my ideas together. I started it almost 10 years ago now, with a little blog and putting my ideas together, and eventually reading more and more, I get involved with parapsychology, I mean the discipline of parapsychology. And I started to see a number of things that for me were connecting together in terms of sociology, in terms of UFOs, and parapsychology together. And so eventually I decided, okay, it's time to put this into a book. And so the book just came out a few weeks ago, and so that's the result of all that work.
Well, it's amazing. I said this, I've said this several times already, but it is absolutely mind-blowing, this book. It really made me think about things in a whole different way. I joked with you the other night when we talked, it's like, for real now, I'm not a joking. This is like the best UFO book I've read since some of the Jacques Vallée stuff. And I'm wondering how you French guys seem to figure out these UFOs better than anybody else. So we need to know what the secret is there.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's just a bit too much wine when you think about UFOs.
But for real, this book is some amazing stuff and makes you look at UFOs from a whole nother angle. Now, you make a great point in the book that, that, you know, words and meanings we use to describe strange things limits our understanding of the whole complex reality of UFOs and all this stuff. And that's kind of a setup in a way, I guess, to sort of bring people up to speed on parapsychology first. Because the listeners, I'm sure, to my program are well aware of the UFO phenomenon and all its lore and legend. I had thought before I picked up your book that I kind of knew a little bit about parapsychology, but the more I read it in your book, I realized I was, you know, that it's a lot deeper and more nuanced than I had imagined. So I guess bring the folks who are listening up to speed on the state of parapsychology, what it is, what it's all about, you know, just sort of give them a thumbnail education so we can lay the groundwork for this conversation.
Well, when I use the word parapsychology, I really refer to, the scientific discipline of parapsychology, because sometimes this word is used very loosely,
right,
to refer to all kinds of things. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. It's a rigorous discipline. And it's only to that form of parapsychology I'm referring to. Parapsychology, a little bit of history is probably useful. Although the word is more than 100 years old now, it really came about in the 1930s under the leadership of Joseph Banks Ryan, who decided to organize scientifically a group of researchers to study paranormal phenomena, but from a scientific perspective. And one of the decisions that they took at that time was to cut the link with what was then called psychical research. So people were interested in talking to the soul of the departed, for instance.
Okay, so sort of like they took out the idea of a sentient other.
Yes, essentially for them, paranormal phenomena are all human produced, and humans are alive with us.
Okay,
right,
that's
now.
Like a keystone of the whole thing, yeah.
Absolutely, and there's a couple of reasons for that, but one of them is of course that people who did psychical research, a lot of them came up with very naive things. A lot of them were conned by people who claimed to be mediums and all these things. So they wanted to have a clean break with this. That's one aspect. The second aspect, of course, is that if your object of study is a non-human entity, you know, a ghost, a spirit, whatever, you can't study it scientifically because we don't know what they are. They show up whenever they want, how often they want, and so there's no way to study patterns.
Hmm.
If you say that these events are produced by us humans, well, we can establish patterns because we can observe humans. We know a fair bit about human beings, and therefore we have a base to start with. So for those two reasons, they decided to have a clean break. So scientific parapsychology, at least in the official version of it, when you talk to them individually, it's a bit different, but at least at the discipline, there's a break with non-human entities. They're not involved. They're not constituted as part of their research and study.
Hmm. Okay. Like I said, that's a key part of the whole thing as we get into this discussion. Now, what I thought was interesting, too, is you point out that you're a member of this Parapsychology Association, but they're pretty adamant that they're not involved in UFOs. They don't even want to look at it, which is interesting in a sense because what you're going in line with the parapsychological thinking. You're not ascribing this to a sentient other. You're ascribing it to the human being. So you are taking a parapsychological approach. But it's interesting that, you know, you say that there's like this wall between the two sort of genres, if you will.
Absolutely. I'm trying to bridge fields of study together through my work. The parapsychologists tended to stay away from the UFO research for a very similar reason they stayed away from psychical research, because unfortunately, as most people know, in the UFO world, there's a lot of people who said a lot of crazy things.
Really?
Yep. And and really, they didn't want to be associated with that. And so for one. And two, if you make the equation UFO and extraterrestrial hypothesis, so the ETH, as being the same thing, well, obviously you're not touching this because, again, the phenomenon then is attributed to a non-human entity or
right,
a group of entities. But if, and that's what I'm trying to do, I can demonstrate that at least it can be studied without intervention of non-human entities, then there's no reasons for parapsychology to ignore UFOs.
Right.
That's the point I'm making.
It's a powerful point, man. It's like I said, it's the great part. I loved your whole introduction. It was like this. I don't know if you know the expression, but it was like this mic drop. It was like this this sort of like slap in the face of the state of understanding of this phenomenon of UFOs. Where you're saying, you know, at the beginning, it's like we've embraced. I don't mean we. I mean like people researching this. They have embraced the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they're opposed by the adamant people that skeptics who say that it's nothing at all, and they've been in this gridlock for almost a century for sure, you know, just since they popped up on the scene. Certainly, in the state of discussing this bizarre phenomenon, it's been this back and forth, black and white thing. And you kind of come in here and you're like, enough's enough. Let's take a fresh look at this from a whole different angle, and that's what we need in the entire field, in a sense.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the idea that there's a paranormal dimensions to the UFO is not new. I mean, it goes back to the 1960s, but it never really made, I would say, headlines within the UFO world.
Inroads, either.
Inroads, yes. And that's very unfortunate because, really, if you pay attention to the details. And you look at the details of cases, that seems to be the only thing that really sticks. And at least if it's humans producing it, we can study it more closely than just hoping that when the aliens will show their face for real.
Exactly. Yeah. And I wanted to like just stand up and cheer. I got to give you kudos here. There's a point in the book where you mentioned that you work for the government and that, you know, people in the conspiracy UFO realm will think that this is part of some cover-up, and you're just like, this book's not for you. You don't, it's just awesome, just the way you said, this book's not for you. It's like, thank you, this book isn't for those folks. This book is for the folks who genuinely want to try and figure this out. I mean, that's all we're trying to do here, is figure this thing out, you know. And it's exciting that you found sort of a new way of looking at this, you know, which is really, really exciting because I've looked at this for so long, and for someone to come along and sort of put, I mean, like you said, this isn't like a new idea, but it's like you really synthesize it into something that I can put in my hands and read and be like, wow, this guy took like a little crappy idea I have in my head and turned it into something awesome. So it's quite the book, folks. Get it. To sort of complete the descriptor here of the parapsychological research, I guess explain to folks, you sort of talked about that we're saying these things come from people, but what are the things, you know, what are the sort of abilities that are ascribed to the humans within these parapsychological concept, if you will?
Well, the key concept of parapsychology is called psi, so PSI. It's coming from the Greek letter. And essentially this, it's explaining, how things can happen without, the intervention of normal means. So I'll explain myself a little bit more. Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of, or two major categories. One is the accessing information through non-normal means. So, and it's usually referred to as extrasensory perception, so ESP, and it covers a whole slew of phenomena such as telepathy, clairvoyance, premonition, and the like.
Okay.
The second category of psi is acting on matter, physical things, again without using normal means. And that's described as psychokinesis, and so PK for short. Mm-hmm. And that includes a number of phenomena, such as throwing the dice and you get the results you want, but it could be healings that are unexplainable, as well as moving objects in poltergeist events or changing, for instance, creating synchronicity where something falls at the time where you're thinking about something.
Yeah.
So these are covers that second category of phenomena. Now, we could push this a little bit further, that some people in parapsychology worked very closely with physicists. And one of the things that, you know, we learn in school is that, you know, matter is actually a combination energy and physical matter. But actually, there's another component, is information. Matter is not just matter, it's organized matter. And the fact that it has an internal composition, has a direction, has a speed, all these elements are actually information that makes matter more than just a pile of dust.
Right.
And so some parapsychologists are saying, well, maybe in the end, psychokinesis is just modifying the information that is in matter. And so ESP is accessing information and PK is just modifying information. So in the end, it seems to be all linked to
information,
our capacity to influence it through non-normal means.
Mm. Okay. I think we've caught everyone up to speed on this. It's amazing. I could talk to you for a while just about this in a sense where it's like, I guess before we do, I do want to know a little bit more is in the sense that, like, who are doing these, what's going on in this realm? Who are doing these studies? What kind of studies are being done on this stuff? Because to me, it's like, this sounds so fantastical. This sounds like stuff that I saw in the checkout line when I was a kid. So, I mean, apparently there are people who are studying this and trying to get to the bottom of it. Who are these people? What are these studies like? What's the state of that research?
The research done in parapsychology is, I would say, mostly done by people who are member of the Parapsychological Association, which is the only scholarly association in that field. There's about 200 members, approximately. And I would say that there are basically two kinds of research done. One kind is more in a lab setting where they're trying to, produce, psi effect, through the classic example is trying to guessing the cards. Now, things have changed quite a bit. They have way more rigorous methodologies and try to insulate people from their own senses and trying different approaches. But the effect that they've seen is more statistical. So if you have a 10% chance of getting right and doing thousands of tests, you get something like 13%. Then that's a deviation that is actually significant from a statistical point of view. So that is a lot of research that in parapsychology that's focusing on these aspects. And on the psychokinesis side is to try to influence random number generators. Machines that just produce numbers through using electronics, and then we try to get people with their mind to influence the electrons. So the numbers or series of numbers that should be appearing, it should be spread evenly, statistically. But so if we see some numbers that are actually spiking more often than not, then again, it's seen as a significant deviation from the statistical average.
Mm.
So that's a very, I would say, dry approach to parapsychology, but it's useful because it helps us to at least understand some of the basics of what it's all about. Then there's a second category of researchers that are more like me. So people who are doing more case studies, more qualitative approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look into, the classic example is to look into a poltergeist event. And they will go and interview the people if they can observe the phenomenon. It's even better. One of the famous parapsychologists who's now deceased, but his name is William Rohl, who did extensive studies on poltergeists and interviewed people. He did all kinds of tests on finding out what kind of personalities that are more prone to these things.
Hmm.
So these are more the qualitative. So that's the second category.
Okay.
Of parapsychologists.
I got to dig more into this. I'm going to have to talk to you off the air or instruct me on where I should. I guess the Parapsychological Association, I got to find some more folks to talk about this with, because this is intriguing stuff. Now, I think now that we've brought people up to speed on parapsychology, the gist of the book is the UFO experience as a parapsychological event. You're suggesting that UFOs are a creation of a psi creation by people, essentially. That's a really bare bones version, but that's the parapsychological hypothesis. Now, I just want to, I guess, get a slight clarification in a sense, because I think I'm right, but I'm not sure. This has nothing to do with like hallucinations, right? This is not like mass hallucination ideas or individual hallucinations, is it?
Yes and no. What I'm saying in my book is that, the well-documented cases where we really don't have an answer, there's some sort of genuine anomaly behind it. But one thing that parapsychologists found is that genuine anomalies are also mixed up with other things at the same time. The classic example is poltergeist. Usually when a poltergeist event, which is, for your listeners, if they're not aware of this houses where there's walls banging and objects moving on their own and people hearing sounds coming from nowhere. And sometimes lots of the furniture is broken by these events.
Yeah, we did a show on it a couple months ago. It's like things go flying around the room and yeah.
But these poltergeist events tend to have a pattern. There's a lot of activities. Well, it starts slowly, then there's a lot of activities, and then goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it goes down, the researchers found that usually the person that seems to be at the center of all this starts to fake it as well, to keep the attention on him or her.
Mm.
There's some sort of psychological need that's behind it. And so, therefore, you rarely have a poltergeist case that is actually purely anomalistic or purely fraud. It's a mix of both. And so, my approach with UFO is the same, is that there is a genuine anomaly, but there might be also, at the same time, some shared hallucination that colors or gives a specific flavor to the anomaly. So, it's not a pure case of it. It's either hallucination or it's an anomaly. It's both. Oftentimes, it's both at the same time.
Okay. All right. It's very, like I said before, it's very mind-bending stuff. So I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it, Eric.
Well, I can give you some examples.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It might be helpful. A simple thing is that some UFO events, what produced the thing in the sky is actually a plane or something really mundane. But the fact that 2, 3, 4, 5 people felt the need to look in that direction and they saw something different than a plane, that's the anomaly. It's not the thing in the sky that is the anomaly. It's the fact that people had a shared, quote-unquote, hallucination. That's anomalistic because there's absolutely no explanation for these kinds of events.
Hold on now. You've confused me.
Yes.
You've managed to confuse me more with that. Now I'm confused. So wait a minute. So are they all together? Are they around in different parts of let's say the same city? And are they seeing the plane or they're all seeing a UFO?
Well, that's the thing is that they see something in the sky. The object that is at the source of you see is just a mundane plane.
Mm-hmm.
However, their perception is being modified.
Okay.
And they see something different. But only those 5 or 6 or 10 people see that. But they see the same thing and they're not connected to each other.
Okay.
That's what is an anomalistic. So if you talk about UFOs as in some instances as a shared telepathic hallucination, if you want, that's truly anomalistic because we're in the realm of the transmission of information by non-normal means. But the ultimate object behind is not abnormal. So again, it's not a matter of either or. Oh, there's a plane in the sky, therefore nothing happened. Well, no, something happened, but it was not in the sky. It was among the people.
Right, right. Well, I think this speaks to what you're talking about in the very early part of the book about the double dynamic of the personal and the impersonal with regards to UFOs and how there's two sort of elements to it, and it's very flummoxing how these can work together at the same time, but they seem to do that.
Yes, this probably is the most challenging aspects of UFO is that experiencers have a very personal experience and it's their own, and no one can really challenge what they live because they live what they live. And yet, other elements, the other aspects of their experience are actually shared with others or produced by something else that has nothing to do with them. So they have a very personal experience into a much larger experience that would be impersonal. If I can make an analogy with simple things, it's like if you are in a crowd, angry crowd during a demonstration, that's the impersonal force. And yet, you as an individual, you may have a very nice chat with the police officer that tried to control the crowd. And you have a very different personal experience than the overall impersonal or collective experience. So, but these phenomena are seen in not just in parapsychological situation, but in normal situation. And again, it's just a different way to look at a UFO. So again, if you think about the UFO wave, like in Belgium and many other places, people saw very different things, and yet they were in the same city, and so they had the personal experience that was quite different. And yet there was one larger experience happening in the town or in the country about UFOs. And the fact that a witness saw, let's say, a saucer-shaped object, and 2,000 others saw a rectangular and 2,000 saw a triangular one, doesn't matter. It doesn't make it false. People have a personal experience, and there's the larger wave as a different set of experiences that needs to be analyzed on its own terms rather than be reduced to an accumulation of individual observations.
Okay. Like I said, folks, this is strap yourselves in. we're getting deep into this stuff. Well, let me ask you this then. So you're saying, I want to go back in a sense to the analogy that the scenario that you painted here of the five people. They mistake the plane for UFO. You say something anomalous is happening here. I guess let's take that further and sort of apply what you're suggesting here. What are you suggesting? That one person of the five is conjuring this sort of vision for the other four, or it's a collective, or what?
Well, the research in parapsychology into what we can call the collective psi, or if you think a lot of people, thousands of people, we can call it social psi. The research that was done is with small groups is that everyone is contributing into it, and the end result is not really the output of one particular individual. It's the output of everybody, and so this thing then seems to be completely foreign to the individual. I'll give you a very specific example.
Let me just jump in and ask you just so, because I think I'm getting it. So in a sense, let's say I look up at the plane, okay, and you're across town, you look up at the plane, and like two other people do too, and it's sort of, at that moment, it's like almost all these like strings connect to just the information, let's say, for lack of a better term, of this dot in the sky, and then there's some kind of synthesis.
That's it. Absolutely. It's the synthesis of people's unconscious mind being projecting things and yet connecting with others at the same time.
That's amazing.
But this connection is not the property, if you want, of any particular individual. It's something they created together, not even aware they're creating this together.
Wow. That's amazing. It makes sense. It's exciting in a way. It's like the old idea of, you know, your girlfriend's across the country, and you're like, I'm looking at the same moon you are. It's like that romantic idea.
Yes, exactly. And a famous experience in this field, in the parapsychology here, was called the Philip Experiment. It was done in the early 70s in Toronto. Now, there's a group of people who created an artificial ghost. So they, together, there was sitters, so 7 or 8 of them, and they worked together in creating a story of someone who was deceased and started to put to flesh out the story as they go with their seance. And eventually, something started to happen that the creature, quote-unquote, they created, started to respond by psychokinesis, by knocks on the table. And they started to ask questions to the thing they created, and it was answering back. But it was not the creature itself. It's all these unconscious together that was putting energy in something and responding back to them. But they consciously created a ghost, quote-unquote. That's a very fascinating experiment.
Right, right. Is this also kind of like the tulpa idea?
Similar, although the tulpa is, I think it's a quite misunderstood concept. If you read the book by Alexandra Niels, there's 6 pages in our entire book about this. That's it. And really, again, she saw that monk that she created, and she said that someone else saw it, but just in the corner of his eye. So, again, is it an hallucination but shared telepathically? Something of that nature. Even that is anomalistic, but doesn't mean that monk has a true physical presence in a strict sense of the word.
Right.
So again, the anomaly is that they share the same information.
Mm. All right. Now, what I thought was interesting in the book is that you spend quite a bit of time sort of, what's the best way to put it? I guess sort of showcasing, highlighting, talking about sort of possible, and I'm using, I guess, yeah, I don't need quotes here, natural causes for the UFO forms, like ball lightning, plasma, and sort of electromagnetism effects, if you will. I thought that was interesting, and it sort of ties into the idea, like when I first asked you if this is a hallucination or not, because there's a part of me sort of coming out of the book that thought maybe you were also suggesting that there's a psi element that might be able to conjure these things like ball lightning and plasma.
Yes, I started to talk about, let's say, shared information, but that doesn't mean that in other situations there's no physical agents.
Right.
I mean, non-human agent, non-intelligent agent involved. One of them that is a very strong culprit in all this is plasma. Either it's created by very odd weather conditions, or it's created by the Earth, coming out from the Earth. These seems to be involved in many UFO sightings. But the research has shown is that these are highly magnetized. And high magnetism has an influence on the human brain. It makes us, quote-unquote, hallucinate. But also, high magnetism, according to some researchers, enhance psychic capabilities at the same time. So, again, there might be a physical object, although it's kind of a bubble of stuff, of hot gases, that interact with us in a sense of through the electromagnetism. They influence our brain, and strangely enough, we human beings have the capacity also to influence electromagnetic systems.
Hmm.
So research in parapsychology is pointing to this distinct possibility. So if you are encountering one of those bubbles, it may actually set your brain to see something different, and you will interact with that bubble in certain ways that are, quote-unquote, again, an hallucination. You will see things that you project into it. You won't see the bubble.
Right. And you almost don't even need to see. You almost, and there's also the idea that maybe you don't even need to project an image on, because if it's a bubble, I mean, how isn't like one of the classics just a ball of light? People see a ball of light and they think it's a UFO. It's like, it kind of makes you, what you're saying, even more palatable.
Yes, but people may see things that are quite different than the bubble. They can see a manufactured object. They can see entities.
Okay.
So that can lead to these types of hallucination, quote unquote, again. But again, what is interesting is that when people start to have to share, and we think telepathically share those hallucinations, it becomes quite interesting. And it gives a different explanation to the UFO event.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we kind of established here that you're not just saying that these are straight up like hallucinations, but there's also this possibility that people are conjuring things, and then also that the electromagnetic element to all this. It does seem like there needs to be more, you know, study into that whole thing, because maybe this is a really mundane question, I apologize, but like, if someone saw one of these, how far away does the bubble have to be to influence someone? How strong is this electromagnetism?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
We know that to really hallucinate, you have to be very close, a very strong source of electromagnetism. So the question is that if let's say there is a ball of plasma in the sky, it could be quite a distance from you. How does it influence, or how does it connect with your brain? That we don't know. That's an unknown. So, but again, the fact that there is something strange in the sky makes us at least think about UFOs, and then there might be other conditions that we don't understand that enhance the capacity for us to have some sort of interactions with that bubble. But that's like, I don't go into that in my book, because the science about this is really embryonic.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting. Is it considered dangerous? Like, do they do tests with this electromagnetic stuff? Because I'd be interested if they could just, like, generate one. Not if they can't generate, you know, the bubble. It would be interesting if they could somehow generate some proxy for the bubble to see if they could influence people somehow.
Well, the Canadian researcher, Michael Persinger, that did that kind of experiments, and that's where we know that close proximity to sources of electromagnetism does induce various types of images, and that are felt as very real and very vivid. He did other researches, though. When I talk about the two-way street, there was a poltergeist problem in the house. And one of the things that was well measured was a young woman that she slept in her bed, and her head was very, very close to her electrical alarm clock.
Huh.
And the time on the alarm clock moved way faster than the normal time. So she was influencing also that electronic equipment. But an alarm clock does not produce a lot of electromagnetic field. So again, how much you need to have an interaction, it's hard to say. But in that one example, it seems that you don't need a lot.
Jeez, I keep my alarm clock at the foot of my bed and right by my head, and it always runs like 2 minutes slow. So I don't know. That makes me nervous. I feel like we've laid all the groundwork we need here, because I want to get into now sort of I'm sure, I don't even know if he's still around, but I don't have the man's name, and you can fill it in, I'm sure. But the sort of big tentpole of the book, the sort of the device, if you will, that you use to sort of put into these cases and look at them with the parapsychological hypothesis is this model of pragmatic information, which is a four-step series of events, let's say. I'm going to have you give everybody the explanation, but I'm going to give them a short one, which is like surprise, displacement, decline, and then suppression. And what Eric has done is sort of applied this, which comes from the study of poltergeists, to UFO cases, and it's amazing how it matches up, folks. It really is amazing, and that's what we're going to really dig into now. So tell people about this model of pragmatic information. It sounds daunting, but once you sort of begin to work with it, it's an amazing way of looking at things.
The scientist that developed this, his name is Walter von Lukadu.
There he is.
He's a German physicist and parapsychologist, and he's running actually a parapsychological clinic, if you want, in Germany, in Freiburg, and he's a professor also at the University of Freiburg. He did a lot of empirical investigation. So he went in person and studied a lot of those poltergeist events, interview families, interview the people involved. And over time, he noticed this pattern that those four phases that at the beginning, it seems to start very slow, lots of intensity, then it declines and disappears. But what is more interesting is that he started to notice also that some people are more involved in certain phases, and it seems that the involvement of those people actually influence the events. So poltergeists are usually considered as being the fact of one person, oftentimes a teenager, but not always, who has some very personal challenges at the emotional level, but cannot express them for whatever reason. Difficult family dynamics is usually the culprit here. And to use psychokinesis becomes an alternate way to communicate and try to get attention. So what's going on is that at the beginning, that is called usually the focus person, because the focus is on that person, and that person's environment, so the immediate family, the immediate friends, have a surprise at the beginning. They wonder what's going on, what is this, and they start to look around for possible reasons. As the phenomenon continues to grow, then usually it's when the psychic arrives, the people with very strong beliefs in life after death try to counsel them, to try to help them, try to provide them with all kinds of ways to deal with this entity. But usually what they do is that they actually reinforce the belief that whatever happening in the house is caused by a spirit, a non-human entity. And it's called displacement because of that reason. And instead of looking at the person's problem, which is the source of all this, they displace the problem in looking at all kinds of other things. And so that's where you have people try to, banish the spirit from the house, and they do all kinds of rituals, and they get a priest, depending on their belief system. And that's when the phenomena really reach a very high point. But then, usually after a certain time, for a few days, a few weeks, depending on the case, then, much more, skeptical observers arrive on the scene. And they start to take much more, narrow measurement about where the noise is coming from, where are everyone when something moves.
Right.
And at that time, surprise, surprise, we have a phenomenon that is much less intense and start to disappear, which is the decline phase. And at the end, usually you have a situation where the authorities have been involved or called upon, you know, the police or the social workers, and they're tired of this and they want to put an end to this. I don't want, and that's usually they declare that some fraud happened, or people really just try to prank their neighbors, etc.
Right.
And that's the cover up, and that's when it ends. But there are physics reasons also behind this, because Vahoukadu used the concept of non-locality. What it means, non-locality, it's based on a physics experience. When you have two protons that are launched into a tube, if you want, and then at the end of the tube, there's a splitter. So it forces protons to go, one to go to the left, the other one to go on the right. But what happened is that their spin, the way they turn on themselves, is exactly the same, even though they're not connected with each other. And that puzzled scientists quite a bit. How can two particles share the exact same information without being connected with each other and being part of now two different systems? Mm-hmm. So that's the notion of non-locality. So they share information without being together. So you use this idea and say, well, why not look at this at the macroscopic level? So we have near, you know, the macrophysics and the macroscopic level, then people would share also information non-locally, and that's when things happen. So telepathy in this situation is that people think the same thing at the same time. That's an example that is of non-locality. And what Vahoukadu noticed is that these things can only happen if the people, the systems, as he calls it, do not determine the thing. So in your head, when you're, I'll give an example for telepathy, it usually happens when we're absent-minded. We're looking at the sky, or we're not really thinking. And that's that our mind is in a state of flux. Mm-hmm. That's, to use the words of Vahoukadu, is indeterminate. And that's just the time where these non-local connections can happen. So go back to poltergeist. As the phenomenon is not on the focused person, then everybody is looking around, trying to find a spirit, trying to find some religious explanation. So the system that is really producing this, so the focused person and the environment, is indeterminate. So it allows the phenomenon to grow. When the skeptical observers arrive on the scene, they actually narrow every single possibility, and therefore they reduce the indeterminacy in the system.
Mm.
And so psi phenomena have way less chances to happen in those circumstances. And that is backed up by all the lab research the parapsychologists have done, is that if you have a very, very stringent experiment, you will produce nothing. You have to allow free flow of the unconscious mind to be liberated and do whatever it wants. Then you have more chance to have a psi effect.
Right.
And then at the very end, because authorities, you know, they don't like to have stories of poltergeist, you know, houses where
yeah,
all kinds of things going on. So they really crush and put an end to any forms of indeterminacy by declaring that's actually a fraud, by encouraging people to come forward. Sometimes even these court cases happen in Germany. So they really crushed the whole thing.
Hmm.
So that's the what happened with poltergeist. And like you mentioned, I've seen very similar pattern if you look at UFO waves, at least in a number of them.
Yes. We're going to get into that in a moment. In the decline stage, is it possible that a big part of the decline, too, is that by human nature, indeterminacy would lessen, because this thing's been going on and people kind of, like, the first impression stage is over and people just come to some kind of conclusion, whether they're right, wrong, or blue in the face. You know what I mean? Like, some people are just like, straight up, it's a ghost. Other people, you know, so there's sort of a disbursement of people. Instead of everyone being like, I wonder what this is, everyone sort of like takes sides, I guess, if you will.
When people take sides, as long as they take sides with the notion that it's non-human forces that create that, it actually allows the phenomenon to continue for a longer time.
Ah, okay.
That's because, again, they don't look at the actual problem. Because in a poltergeist event, when you have a person who is in emotional distress, unless their distress is some sort, somehow relief, they will try to find, again, to send a cry for help, a message. And so that's really the determinant. But in a classic poltergeist case, eventually people figure out, okay, you know, these things only happen when so-and-so is in the room. And, you know, when that person is away, never anything happens. So then they start to focus on that person, and then that person starts to get attention, which is the first step to be able to talk about your problem.
Right, people, right, right.
You have the attention of people now. And that's also, at that time, as I mentioned earlier, that to be able to keep the attention, then oftentimes they start to engage in trickery.
Right, that's the next thing I was going to ask you about. Yeah. That has anybody ever sort of, it would be interesting to find out these people who are in these positions. Do you know what I mean? Because it would be interesting to know what was in their mind when they decided to start hoaxing. Because did they know that they had were causing it all along, but they couldn't figure out why? Or I mean, that's kind of an interesting avenue to explore in a way.
Yes, although I mean, people were interviewed about this by parapsychologists who are themselves psychologists, so they really went into depth with this, and it's really the need for attention, because they need it. And so they find ways to get it. And when the phenomenon starts to decline, then people pay less attention to this. They pay less attention to them. Mm. And it's an unconscious process. People usually don't think this through. They just act on it. And they make a little noise here, and they try to throw a glass without when nobody's is watching.
Right.
So, and again, this is the challenge of all these types of phenomena is that they're never pure. They're always a mixture of genuine anomalies and other things.
I guess the question I had though was, has anyone ever talked to these focused people, and has any of these focused people ever sort of explained or said, yes, I was doing these things with some kind of psi ability I don't understand, but then as people came along, I couldn't do it anymore, but I felt the need for the attention, so I faked it, is what I'm asking you. Do you know what you get kind of what I'm saying?
Some people, I mean,
I'm sure like victims or quote unquote, the focused people in these cases, they're already few and far between, and then to get them to open up in an honest fashion is probably even more difficult. So I know I'm kind of like asking for the moon here, but I figured, I wonder if anyone's ever kind of come forward with that kind of account.
Well, yeah, I mean, some people came forward saying, yes, you know, I did things, and on, but, you know, they were teenagers, so they were acting impulsively. Then they are interviewed, you know, a number of years later as adults, and had the chance to reflect, and yes, they would admit that they were looking for attention, and continue the attention they were getting because of the phenomenon. But the actual production of the phenomenon, they are not aware of it, because this is the unconscious part of the mind that produces them.
Right.
And they're not aware of it. Usually as surprised as other people around at the beginning, definitely, yeah.
Oh, okay. But when they talk to them later in retrospect, are they aware of it then?
Well, if they have the chance to have a good discussion with someone who knows about these things, then they definitely would agree that they had some very serious challenge emotionally.
Hmm.
And that the it happens at the same time that they had those challenges. So they kind of see that they are probably having a role to play in this.
Yeah.
But again, depends who with whom they debrief afterward.
Because
if they are in the hands of true believers in Spiritism, then
good luck to them.
It won't happen.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we've set everybody up here with this is kind of like step by step, and I really do appreciate you, Eric, trying to help me out with this, because I really do love what you've done with this book. So what you're saying now is we apply this model of pragmatic information, the surprise, the displacement, the decline, and then the suppression. We apply this to UFO waves And what do you know? They fit. That's the amazing part. I guess, when did you even come up with sort of doing this? Like, well, how did this even, I mean, kudos, man, for putting this all together, but like, were you just like, wow, what happened here?
One of the things that I started with, because I'm a sociologist, so I look more at larger groups, you know, entire population, and I had this intuition, I would say, because nothing more than that at the time, that maybe psi can happen when there's a lot of people involved, but it, of course, takes a different shape. And then I started to say, well, okay, maybe UFOs are just that. And the first case I really look into was the UFO wave of 1952, centered around Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to see a couple of things that were really odd. It happened at a very specific time of tensions in Washington. The time of the Democratic Convention, it was a time where McCarthyism was very intense. But there's a lot of factors that it's strange that it happened in that city at that time. There was a lot of things accumulating. So I figured, well, maybe we have some sort of poltergeist using, but has a UFO shape rather than object in a house. But it's not one person or a small group of person, but hundreds, maybe thousands of people that actually have some sort of influence over that.
Yeah, it's like a poltergeist for a region, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting way of putting it. That's a great way of putting it. So I guess you cover three separate major cases in the book, and then a couple of other ones. I hesitate to give away the book, but I want to cover one of these waves, and I think the DC one resonates the most with people. Unless there's some other wave or case or something that you didn't put in the book that you want to that you want to talk about, so folks, you know, don't get the whole thing, but I feel like we can best explain all this by showing it in action with the DC wave.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Again, just to show that the power of this the MPI is that I'm in the middle of writing an article for a parapsychology journal where I use the Marian apparition in Egypt of the late 1960s. And so we're not talking UFOs here, but the pattern is the same. The involvement of skeptics, the involvement of believers, it's the same thing. It's fascinating.
Right. So you say you can apply this to the Marian apparition from the 60s.
Well, so yeah. The model has a lot of strength.
It's I'm telling you, Eric, I'm praising you to the high heavens here. This is some. You know, thank you for bringing this to the attention of me and all the listeners with this amazing book. So let's dig in, I guess, to the DC wave. Let's walk people through it. Because that's the one I think is most palatable to this audience. They've heard of the DC wave relatively, so you don't need to really give them, you know, the whole nine yards on what it was all about. I mean, it was a 1952 wave over Washington, D.C. You're going to fill in the pertinent details to the MPI, so... You know, without any further ado, I'm just going to get out of your way. Explain how this all works together.
All right. Well, the wave, actually, one of the things that I noticed is that, and I'm not the first one, of course, to do that, but UFO waves tend to have a center or tend to be focused in one specific area or a couple of specific areas, if the wave lasts longer, in the case of the Belgian one, for instance. But the wave was general in the United States, but in the month of July, 1952, that was the most intense month of unexplainable UFO observations. And so that's the first thing, is that if you look at the wave, there seems to be a center of it, or an epicenter, like an earthquake, if you want. Mm-hmm. There's one place that seems more important. And Washington, D.C., the two sightings over two weekends are the center of that center. And it's really at the most intense part of the wave in July that happened. So that's the first thing. There is some sort of geography to it. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that I found intriguing. Then the timing is also was interesting because the two main events of the DC wave were very closely aligned with the Democratic Convention of 1952, where they selected Adlai Stevenson as the candidate for presidency. And at that time, there was a lot of tensions among the civil service because there was the McCarthyism, so really people were paranoid about having Soviet spies everywhere, and the government, federal government, put a lot of rules in place to limit what the civil servants can do. A lot of them lost their job on simple suspicions that were completely unfounded, we discovered later on. So there was a period of very tense time.
Right.
So that's another key element. And one of the things that, if we go back to Poltergeist, people want to have attention. So usually the phenomena grab the attentions of the people that the focus person really need. And in the case of the DC wave, it's clear that where these phenomena appeared, somehow the military was called. They could not have not seen that message. And though that it started in a civilian airport, the first thing these people did is actually check with the military. You know, do you have the same radar signal we got?
Right.
And so this adds to this notion, okay, we have a period of high tension, McCarthyism, we have phenomena that seems to seek the attention of the military. And then now we know, after the fact, of course, we have the benefit of the hindsight, that that's actually the U.S. Army that stood up to McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, and brought an end to this nonsense. So it seems to be somehow that there is a collective premonition that their best ally to get rid of this very difficult time, and civil servants couldn't speak about that. You know, they were completely muzzled about this issue.
Right.
We're seeking out somehow the involvement of the military. I mean, this symbolically that the whole wave seems to be centered around this notion.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.